Roman Halter, Reel 14. When you married, was your wife Jewish?
Well, she's Jewish, yes.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Was it important for you, do you think, to marry someone?
Yes, it was. Yes, somehow this was important. Again, I carried that within me. And we met on a competition for the Maccabiah, and that was a competition in Israel. And we married. I also remember that the families in our town, also in our family, one married not out of love, but there was somebody the parents chose through matchmakers, the right partner. So, although I wasn't so deeply in love, head over heels, I found she's a suitable partner for me. I don't know how she would take it now if she heard what I said. It's all right. But she proved a wonderful mother and good wife, and we shared so many interests together, and it turned out very well.
Did your wife have any experience of the Holocaust?
Yes, she was taken in 1944 in Budapest and led towards the Austrian border, and she escaped from that. And eventually her father managed to get her false papers. It was a very courageous step to take because she saved her sister, her elder sister. The Hungarian police were not like the SS. She managed to slip him some money and then step behind a block and let her blonde hair down and went back. She paid relief. The money which was given to this Hungarian soldier was he took some people by card, you know, it's his private enterprise, in order to not to obey the order. So it was only the sister, but other people he took. The people who were taken together with her and who did not escape never returned.
So you have a shared experience.
Yes, in that way.
Yes, was that a good thing, do you think, that you had that?
Yes, she understood me. I didn't have to be very explicit about things. And she was also very courageous because when we married in 1951, we were both penniless. And we were brave enough to start a family. And we didn't think it was tough. We just accepted that the world didn't owe us a living. And we got on with life, and England and freedom were marvelous. Well, I do come across some people, some Holocaust survivors, who would like to forget about it, and I understand them, because they suffer nightmares, they suffer traumas, and they feel if they're going to talk about it and bring it to the surface, they will have greater nightmares and greater traumas, and they want to get through life in the easiest and pleasantest way. So they teach themselves bridge in order to pass certain times. Those who are retired now, they go to cinemas. They're not great theater goers or opera goers. Some like perhaps music, but on the whole not so. And they do it because really this remembering of that past is something which disturbs the existence now. But I cannot understand people like Yogi Meyer, who came before the Second World War to this country and acquired a certain position over young people where he says, the past must be forgotten, get on with the future, do this, do that. because really this past ought to be recorded, ought to be remembered, ought to be analyzed, ought to be written about, ought to be thought about, so that the world doesn't derail itself again. And it is a vital lesson, because suddenly, assuming so many hundreds of years later, we say, oh, I wish we had a record of what happened. And Jewish people find that they have a very slight record of what happened in Spain when they were expelled. And they wish they would know more about it. They wish they knew more about the poets that exist, the Jewish poets, and all the little details that lead up to it. In fact, history is remembering, and without remembering, we are a blank slate. Unfortunately, the bad and good things ought to be recorded. Not only the very good things, but everything has to be recorded. And from that, we draw conclusion, learn lessons, and hope to advance in a saner way. Whether we do or not, this is a different matter. But if our leaders cannot choose between good and evil, they might choose evil. Yes, also advice of people like the person Horowitz I mentioned to you. He was a student in a university, and he listened to somebody called Brodetsky, who was a very good mathematician, a great brain. And during the times of Second World War, when they heard that this is what's happening to the Jews in Europe by Hitler, these students came up and said, what ought we to do? Now he should say, yes, you have to take the responsibility of showing that we are fully behind these people, to give them hope, even if our missions are not successful, that we know about it and we are trying to do something, and you, being a young student, would be one of them to take this courage, because we really thought that the world does not care about us, they don't know about us. But instead, what I said, your duty as a student is to pass your exam and not to concern yourself with that. Many great people can be misled. They can be very clever in their subjects, but very unwise when it comes to human beings and action. When I attended the Imperial War Museum lecture, or not lecture really, there were various people who were talking, and somebody on the table, a gentleman who is, I think, on the committee here, or chairman of this committee, said it was sufficient to read the speech by Himmler of October 1943 now to find what terrible things were said, that all Jews must vanish from Europe. I think really the realization is slowly sort of getting to people that we all human beings inhabit this world, and we all have a right to our lives in dignity and respect. We are all equal in dignity. And I think this principle must govern our way of behavior. The differences are wonderful. They should be celebrated. But the differences are also that one should respect the other and feel that collectively we are inhabiting the earth.
You mentioned earlier, you know, the myth of the Orthodox Jews, and there is another myth. The Jews were lambs to the slaughter. You've explained how you saw that awful scene in the ravine. You know, what do you think? Could those people have done anything? Could Jews in the ghetto have done any more, or in the camps? What do you think of this sort of slogan or myth, lambs to the slaughter?
Yes, I like to answer that. Yes, can I speak? Yes. Well, Jewish people lived in Poland, another state, by not being armed. They lived by the book. In fact, the Torah was the land of Israel. From the expulsion, the land of Israel was sort of embodied in the Torah, and being Jewish meant repeating traditionally the dictates of the Torah. And they were not people who were armed to the teeth. They were in fact not armed. As soon as Hitler's army entered Poland, he took all the leaders in every town and shot them. So every town was neutered of leadership. And then he took the very fit man, either for slave labor, to build it, Berlin, Posen, Line, or Helmno, or so on. And the massacre began very quickly with the strongest and the ablest. By the time we reached ghetto, we were really, we consisted of elderly women and children. And also, depriving us of sustenance, being starved, we could not resist against armies, against people with machine guns, with bayonets, with boots, with vicious dogs. Who could do anything about it? If we really think that the Warsaw Uprising had a few men with very few guns, who were chased from one building to another, and if one really examines the resistance, it was just simply that there was courage amongst the very few and ingenuity of not being caught. But most of the people really were weak, elderly, very young. And this idea of fighting, resisting, was never instilled, ingrained into them. There were a few Zionist organizations in the bigger towns, and these people constituted the ones in the Warsaw Uprising. But otherwise, if one was taught how to use guns, if one was prepared for this, perhaps, and if one had the ammunition, but this was ipso facto, it was totally unrealistic to think about the few starved, undernourished thousands or millions were not equipped to deal with the German armies, with the brutal German army. They were not led like sheep to slaughter. They were taken like human beings to be murdered. And they could do absolutely nothing. The plan for murder was thought out with tremendous precision. And they knew also that when you take people to Auschwitz, instead of making the journey in 4 hours, they locked them up in these compartments. Took 3 days over it. These people came thirsty, disorientated. And of course, they had no resistance at all. So this is all very, very wrong to say that. And they learned from each transport. They could intensify the guards or strengthen the guards. And they behaved in such a brutal way that the whole brutality paralyzed people when they saw it.
Do you ever get sort of nightmares or bad dreams about your experience, Roman?
Yes, I do. And there are certain experiences, like the experience of the ravine, which I've witnessed. And I was not quite 13 then. which come back into dreams, and these dreams wake me and leave me quite fatigued in the morning. It's not fatigue because they wake me, it's just simply because of the dreams I have, and they're all jumbled up. And when I think about them, this ravine experience comes into it together with various other experiences, and they're so jumbled up with everyday work that it's sometimes very hard to push it out of one's mind. What does really help me to push it out of my mind is when I have certain creative work, which I do. And that work, like stained glass windows, painting, really makes my days happy and my nights better. But for no apparent reason at all, I can see a cinema, a film, which would be quite ordinary, but then the past comes into it, and I can dream, and the dream is all jumbled up with it. And it is very vivid in the dream. And although certain things which occurred 20 years ago do not come into the dreams, that does. And I wish it hadn't. What can I say?
How much did you see of that massacre in the ravine?
Well, I don't know in terms of minutes or so, but the worst part was when this boy and his sister, when they were taking him and she clung on to him, and the order was given to smash his skull, and his skull was smashed, and then they were both dragged there. It was something that really paralyzed me in a way that, although I felt I should get away, certain part of me, I could not move. And it was really such a paralyzing experience that I, even now when I think about it, I cannot sort of reconcile this brutality before the murder. Well, that's all I have can say about this, but how much have I seen? Enough, really, to shake the core of my being.
When we were talking last time, you were, we ended up by you sort of talking to me about the searches you have made through time for, you know, various, I think it was your sister, wasn't it?
Yes. She was sent to Warsaw, and then she couldn't come out from the ghetto, and then was sent to Lodz. When she was in Warsaw, we could still, from our town, send her parcels. She was 6 years my senior, almost 7 years. And then after the war, when I decided to summarize in forms of painting my experiences of the Holocaust, rather than talk about it, I was in Naharia. And I learned that about 4 kilometers away, south of Naharia, was the kibbutz Beit Lohamei Hagetaot, and consisted of ghetto fighters from Warsaw. And there was the man, Itzhak Zuckerman, who was called Antek, a nickname Antek. And I went there to see him and his colleagues. And my aunt sent me a photograph from Switzerland of my sister. That was many years back. When I was still in a hostel. And I took this photograph with me to show them what she looked like, whether they could recognize it, to find out whether they came across her. And they said no. And knowing that I'd been an architect, Zuckerman showed me around the museum, also took me outside, and he showed me the place outside. And he said that a memorial and educational center to the child who died in the Holocaust, the 1.5 million children who perished in the Holocaust, would be a fitting thing to have. He said it would be like a right arm to the whole body of the Beit Lohamei Haggadot. And I started corresponding with him, and I sent various sketches of how I conceived it. And he liked the sketches, but he said, you know, this is more of a memorial. What we want is an educational center where other people can come along and be taught, because we have so much material about the Holocaust. We have archives here. But then also, through another colleague of mine, I met somebody called Dr. Iwiański, who is in Ein Harod Kibbutz, and also knew Zuckerman. And together with Iwiański, who formed a committee there, we took this idea of Yad Layelet forward. And the idea started really in 1979 and then went on. From this sort of seed, the whole thing grew, till eventually this Yad Layelet is now a living reality, and it's functioning very well. And I developed this idea together with my son. And not having an office in Israel, my architectural drawings, together with my son's drawings, were passed on to somebody called Ram Karmi, who did the Supreme Court in Jerusalem. And he studied with me at the Architectural Association. Because when I started in architecture, I started evening classes, and then I won a scholarship to the Architectural Association School of Architecture, where I studied full-time. It was pretty hard because we had then two children and we had a very small grant. And so to supplement the grant, I had to work every weekend and on holidays. And I did all kinds of jobs on holidays, not wanting always to work in an architectural office. And that was quite a dead experience to one's life. I even got a job really working when Maxwell began Pergamon. I didn't even know who Maxwell was. And I had to cut out illustration, paste them onto paper, where the German translation was translated into English, and the German text was translated into English and pasted on next to the illustration. So that was my first meeting in the 50s with Maxwell, Robert Maxwell. Well, so I went to this Beit Lohamei Haggadot and displayed my photographs. None of them knew this. And this is how my contact with Lohamei Haggadot began. Unfortunately, Zuckerman died in 1981. I think 1981. I became friendly with the director then of Zvi Schneer, a very marvelous man. He was a lawyer and a journalist by profession, a wonderful thinker and great humanitarian man. And then continued on till eventually the whole thing became a reality. And we here in England raised the first $300,000 to start the project, and then it was raised in America and other places. And the place still exists, yes.
Could you explain what you actually did, what you designed, and what was the sort of your thinking behind it, the inspiration behind it, what you aimed to do?
The idea which my son and I, when we talked about it, thought that what we'll do is the whole depth of what most survivors went through is they went from sort of light into darkness. So you come in and you enter a memorial hall, it's almost like a shrine, like an ashram. And this was the main drum, which looks very foreboding, almost like a huge funnel from a ship or funnel from a crematoria, but in fact it's just the opposite. It's a place of joy. You enter and it's circular and it's studded with windows, and the windows, stained glass windows, are based on the little sketches which children left in Theresienstadt before they were taken to Auschwitz-Birkenau. And so these sketches were interpreted and translated into stained glass, and they stud the walls, this drum, all the way around. The whole place is light, and in the roof there is a stained glass consisting of 36 parts of a butterfly, flower, and sun, that hope shall be there always. And children sit, and teachers and educationists talk to them. And it's a very happy place, and they study these windows. And then along a ramp, they descend down and see the ghettos, the partisans, till eventually they come to the lowest area, which is the Korczak Hall, where there's only one flame. And then they come out back again into light. So they get a visual experience, plus the instructions from other teachers. But they're not traumatized by certain pictures which would cause them dreams and shake them into shake them into abnormal feelings. And these ramps which lead up to it are all very gentle and nice, and children begin to comprehend, and they can take very much more than is there. And some of them stay, and they write poems, and they paint pictures, their facilities folded, and come back again because they want to sort of identify and understand what the past was like. This is broadly the idea of Yad Layelet.